Good morning, everybody. I've got to do this thing of I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. All right, they make us all say that. The problem is that antimicrobial resistance is one of the most significant public health challenges facing modern public health, and that's from the World Health Organization in 2007. Antibiotic resistance is just outpacing antibiotic discovery, plain and simple. And the problem is that the antibiotics are overused in food animals, and that's detrimental to human health. That's not the debate. That's pretty much decided by FDA, CDC, USDA, WHO, FAO, OIE, all the acronyms you can come up with. That there is a definitive link between antibiotics for food use, food animal use, and antibiotic resistance in people, or really the bacteria in people. And let's keep in mind that the antibiotics, not all of them, but many of the antibiotics used for animal production are the same ones that are used to treat infections in humans and in animals. So how big is this problem? Well, there's sort of the actual and measured effect of the public health harm, and that's sort of the top part of that iceberg. Thank you to the Danes for giving me a picture of the iceberg. Nearly all common foodborne zoonoses, we can measure that, and we can measure that public health harm. Then there's that sort of actual but hard to measure level of public health harm, and that looking at some of the enterococcal diseases, E. coli that are not foodborne E. coli, what are called extraintestinal pathogenic E. coli, the ones that are responsible for urinary tract infections. And some of the MRSAs. Some of the MRSAs are very human adapted, some of them are animal adapted, some of them are animal that are becoming human adapted. And then we have this sort of potential for future and irreparable harm, but potentially of basically all other infections where you may have an agricultural gene or clone where agriculture is implicated. And you know, this potential is for critically important antimicrobials especially, and there's a huge potential for spread. And we don't really have any really effective downstream controls. Once we get antibiotic resistance, we don't always get rid of it very easily. And antibiotics, one thing that, you know, we certainly all agree on, that every use of antibiotics selects for resistance, whether it's human use, animal use, good use, bad use, ugly use, all of it, every use can potentially give us antibiotic resistance. I have antibiotics or societal drugs, and what I mean by that is if you think about how most drugs are used in humans, if you think about your blood pressure medication, diabetes medication, if you take it or you don't take it, that affects you. It's affecting your body, and it will affect you the same way in 10 years that it does now. It'll affect your children, your grandchildren the same way that it does you now. Antibiotics are different. They don't affect you. They're affecting the bacteria. Those bacteria do change, and so it's really what you do really has a public health and a community impact that you know, they're society drugs. So what you do or don't do with antibiotics, or what animals do or don't do with antibiotics, really affects the use and the ability of the antibiotic to work or not work in the entire community. So one person's use of an antibiotic can diminish the effectiveness of the antibiotic for the next time for either that person or for the community. So I think I'll skip over most of this of how antibiotic resistance happens. I think most of you know that you have a resistant population, a susceptible population, you add antibiotics, and the resistant population is the one that dominates. And keep in mind that a few generations to a bacteria is measured in minutes. So in 10 hours, you can go from one bacteria to a billion bacteria. So their generational time is measured differently than ours are. And how do antibiotics or how do bacteria get that resistance? Well, there's that sort of mutation that you can get when you've got that many generations of bacteria. But also bacteria are very good at sharing their resistance. And these shared resistance genes, these transferable genetic elements, can get into the genome of the bacteria. They can also move from the pathogenic bacteria to commensal bacteria. And keep in mind, the antibiotics don't just seek out the bad guy. They don't just get to the bacteria you want them to get to. They can affect all the bacteria that are around. That process isn't always straightforward. It's not always linear. You can't do an easy model where you can say, you know, if you do this, then at this amount of time, this is going to happen. We just don't have those models. We just don't know. The bacteria do things on their own time schedule. But we do know that resistance plasmids is probably the most common way that we get resistance to antibacterial drugs. There's also phages, which are I think of them as, and they're viruses that infect bacteria. That's another way. And then the third way is that when bacteria die and they open up, that free DNA can be picked up and is sometimes picked up by bacteria, and they incorporate it into their genome. So even if a bacteria is dead, that doesn't mean that their resistance has gone away. And somebody had mentioned that earlier, talking sort of about the environmental, some of the environmental issue. So from livestock to people, we know that resistant bacteria have been detected in air more than 160 yards downwind from swine feedlots. We've seen multi-drug resistant bacteria in topsoil of dairies, resistant E. coli in drinking water near hog facilities. We've looked at the role of cockroaches and flies in spreading bacteria and antibiotic resistant bacteria. There's been studies of meat in our food supply that they consistently find pathogenic bacteria in meat and resistant bacteria. And you can look at, as Dr. Wong talked about, NARMS data that looks at how much antibiotic resistant bacteria we've seen and how much that's changed since 1996. But keep in mind, we've been giving antibiotics since the 1950s, 1960s. So looking at like the last 10 years after we've got this whole, 30 years before that, but nobody was really even looking. There's cross-contamination in kitchens, whether you're looking at your own kitchen, your school kitchen, your hospital kitchen, your kitchen in the restaurants. And I like to think I keep a good kitchen and a clean kitchen, and I've got separate cutting boards and all that, but I can tell you I don't have a sterile kitchen. So they just cook it, just ain't working for me. And then there's direct contact of livestock operators who have direct contact with antimicrobial resistant bacteria. They can pass it on to their families, to friends, to the community. And we're just talking about, and this is just talking about the antibiotic resistance that we're getting from enteric pathogens only, and that sort of straightforward thing that Dr. Wong talked about. So let's talk a little bit more about antibiotics' uses in animal production, which Dr. Wong mentioned a little bit. There's certainly the therapeutic use, and that's where you've got sick animals, or even, I would say, animals that have been exposed to a bacterial disease that you know an antibiotic is going to work. That's a targeted use. There's also a non-therapeutic use, and I call non-therapeutic use is really that which is given to healthy, non-exposed animals. And so I make a distinction. It's a different. I'm using a different definition. And whenever you talk to anybody about anything, make sure you understand the definitions that everybody is using. Non-therapeutic use is for healthy, non-exposed animals. They sometimes it's called, certainly we've got the growth promotion and feed efficiency and sort of using the antibiotics is what I call performance-enhancing drugs. Or the production diseases, the diseases that wouldn't occur if the animals weren't overcrowded and weren't being fed to grow as sort of whatever it takes to get them to grow as fast as possible and large as possible. And it really creates disease or causes diseases that would otherwise be pretty rare to spread like wildfire. And what have we done to answer that? We've added more antibiotics to the feed. So every animal then becomes a potential reservoir for antibiotic resistance. And like I said, the antibiotics are regularly given to healthy animals. As Dr. Wong said, they're legally available over the counter. FDA looked at them and approved them before we had any notion of or concern about resistance. There is little or no veterinary oversight. There's a lot of farms where a veterinarian hasn't stepped on the premises in a couple of years. And they're often administered at these non-therapeutic or very low levels. So you're not giving them at a level that you intend to kill bacteria. You're giving them at a much lower, one-fifth, one-tenth of that dosage. You're not going to kill the bacteria. You're going to make more of them resistant. You've got a complete recipe for becoming resistant. So antibiotics in industrial farms or conventional farms or factory farms, lots of different terms. They really sort of, antibiotics and modern agriculture really sort of grew up together. The answer for some of the issues were let's give them antibiotics because it works. We don't always know why it works, but we know that it works. Sometimes it works. Even the growth promotion, when there are studies that are done on that, about a third of the time when they try to do the studies under controlled conditions, they're not getting that efficiency. even back in the 50s, they realized that the efficiency, they got more efficiency the dirtier the farm was. And there are costs to the farmers. These antibiotics do have, do cost an amount of money. But we really haven't calculated that. We don't always calculate that, and we certainly don't calculate the cost to society of antibiotic-resistant organisms. So really that the antibiotics, especially to promote growth, it's pretty difficult to justify that when we've got so much antibiotic resistance. So how much antibiotic is used? Well, we know total amounts. There's new data. This is the 2009 data from FDA that was collected. The 2010 data just came out on Friday, and that 13.1 million kilograms is now 13.2 million kilograms of total antibiotics that are fed. And that doesn't give you a real good idea of what's going on, because that's total antibiotics, and there's about 9 billion animals a year that are growing up in this country. So that may mean a lot of antibiotic to a few animals or a little antibiotic to a lot of animals. We just don't know. There aren't a lot of details available. We don't know why it's being used. We don't know how much of it's over the counter. We don't know the species breakdown. We just know total amount. But the total amount is a lot. I mean, by anybody's reckoning, 13.1 million kilograms is a lot. And if you look at just the antibiotics that are human, also of human use, because there are some antibiotics that have only animal use, it's still in 2009, and again, I think in 2010, though I haven't looked at all the numbers, it's about 8.5 million kilograms are the same or very similar to the ones that are used in human medicine. And if you compare that to the same sort of sales data that they have for human medicine, there were about 3.3 million kilograms of antibiotics that were sold for human use. And so if you look at that 3.3 versus the, even looking at the 8.5 million kilograms, that means at least 72% of the antibiotics that are used, that have both human and animal use, are used just for food animals. Not animals, food animals. Most of the drugs in humans all the drugs in humans in this country are by prescription use. So like I said, here, some of it's over-the-counter, some of it's prescription. We don't know what's what. I'm going to talk a little bit about actions now, and both international, federal, a little bit on local regulatory agencies and what they've done, guidances from industry and government agencies, and then some legislative kinds of work. The FAO, OIE, which is the World Veterinary Health Organization, essentially WHO, in 2003, said that there was clear evidence of adverse human health consequences because of resistant organisms, because of antimicrobials given to food animals. And that includes, and they said, includes infections that would not have otherwise occurred, increased frequency of treatment failures, including deaths, and increased severity of infections. This panel said antimicrobials should not be used as an alternative to high-quality animal hygiene, and their evidence showed that farmers who stopped relying on the antimicrobials had no economic repercussions for doing that, provided they gave the animals food and water and reasonable shelter. In other words, cost-effective production alternatives exist, and they don't compromise the health of food animals or the producer's bottom line. The European Union did ban the use of all non-therapeutic antibiotics for growth promotion or phased out at the end of 2005-2006, and ultimately the ban on antibiotic agents led to a reduction in the prevalence of antibiotic resistance in animals and meat and humans, and it really has justified their strategy. Now, federal agencies, sort of going from international to federal, the federal agency policies, FDA, as Dr. Sunlove said, FDA is the regulatory agency in charge of antibiotics in humans and animals. And they've got some guidances to restrict overuse in food animals. I'll gloss over that because Dr. Sunlove did a pretty good job of that. USDA has really done a lot more in education. They don't have a regulatory role, but they have education. They acknowledged in a report that the assumed economic and production benefits of antibiotics in animal feed can largely be achieved by improved cleanliness in animal houses and improved testing for diseases, similar to what the WHO had said. They also noted that antibiotics for feed efficiency is not cost-effective for poultry or for grower, finisher hogs. It might be effective and may be useful in wiener pigs, which are baby growing up pigs. And they didn't get any data. They have no data on cattle, so I can't tell you. I just don't know. USDA has recently given out some awards and some grants to look at social attitudes and implications to understand So why are farmers using antibiotics when it's not effective or it's not even cost effective for them? And some of it has to do with, if you're an integrated farmer, you're told this is what you're going to feed the animals, this is how you're going to raise them, and then we'll buy your animals at the end. If you don't do that, then you're in breach of contract. Go find someplace else to get your animals processed, and by the way, good luck with that. And then there's the legislative options, and I'll talk about the legislation, PAMTA, which Dr. Huang also mentioned. I'm not going to go over this very much because, like I said, Dr. Sunloff did a grand job with that, except to say that basically, in my view, Congress basically has criticized FDA for acting before there was a public health crisis instead of reacting to a crisis. You know, whenever there's a crisis, it's like, well, why didn't you prepare for it beforehand? FDA tried to do that, and Congress said, no, don't do that. Like I said, the FDA policy, the guidance 152, was in the 1990s, and guidance number 209, which is the voluntary guidance where injudicious use of antibiotics should, FDA says we don't think that should be done, and that veterinary oversight should be increased, and I think both the other speakers have addressed that pretty thoroughly. I won't go over that again. I do want to talk real briefly about the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, or PAMTA. This year it's Senate Bill, excuse me, Senate Bill 1211 that was introduced by Senator Feinstein from California, and House Bill 965 that was introduced by Representative Slaughter out of New York. And that really limits the use of antibiotics in food animals of the drugs if they're important in human medicine. It doesn't limit the use of antibiotics that are not used in human medicine, but does limit the antimicrobials that, if they're used in human medicine. It still allows for the treatment of sick animals, as would be the veterinary-only drugs. And FDA can give an exception if the industry can show that there's no harm to human health. Basically saying, if they're critically important for human health, don't squander them on healthy animals. That's what PAMTA does. There are some PAMTA supporters, the American Public Health Association. There's most of the health and public health agencies in this country. There's 354 supporters of PAMTA. One of the names you won't see, as you know, is AVMA, who's actively opposing this piece of legislation. So how do we reduce use, and how, from different perspectives? Well, certainly the producers can look at alternatives to non-therapeutic antibiotic uses, and that would include husbandry changes, weaning pigs a little bit later, giving animals a little bit more space, feeding changes to their diets. They certainly do different diets at different ages, and that's certainly down to a science, but looking at, rather than the science of just trying to get them to grow faster, getting them to grow without the need for piling antibiotics on them as well. A USDA survey that was published showed that in swine operators, that 84% of swine operators used, especially the larger ones, gave antibiotics to grower finisher pigs, and 55% of them gave antibiotics to these grower finisher pigs just to get them to grow faster. And there are alternatives that have happened and have worked quite well. The industry has had some initiatives. Once again, they're not rules, they're not requirements, but there are some so-called industry standards. The swine industry has what they call PQA+. One of the pharmaceutical companies, I think it's Pfizer, has what they call the husbandry educator, which is education, says this is what judicious use is. Says you should only use antibiotics to treat specific diseases, and if you use antibiotics for another reason, you should have exhausted your other reasons for using antibiotics first. Those are the standards, but there's no way to audit whether that's been done. And I would argue that if you're using 29 million pounds or 13 million kilograms of antibiotics, that may not be just for therapeutic use. You know, if you've got it's sort of the difference between giving one animal 100 grams of antibiotics versus 100 animals 1 gram of antibiotics. You end up with the same number of antibiotics, but one gives you a lot more vessels for and opportunities for resistance than the other one does. So, most of us are not farmers, most of us are not ranchers. There may be a couple of you in the audience who are, but most of you are not. So what can consumers do? basically, if there's consumer demand, changes can occur. That's how, you know, grassroots changes. The Healthcare Without Harm, there's about 1,500 hospitals in this country that are part of Healthcare Without Harm, and that's a group that looks at ecologically sound and healthy alternatives to healthcare practices. And then of that, there's a subgroup that are part of what's called Food Matters, and they're looking at healthier food in hospitals for patients, staff, and visitors, including getting meat that's produced by animals that haven't been given non-therapeutic uses of non-therapeutic antibiotics, figuring that if they can control antibiotic resistance in their hospital and can reduce that even by one patient, that they've saved their hospital a fair amount of money. Retail changes, you know, people asking for meats that have been grown, animals that have been grown without the use of antibiotics except to treat the animals. There are some reliable labels, consumer labels, that there's the organic label, there's also a label that says this meat or this poultry was grown, was raised without antibiotics. And then there's most of the meat, 98% of the meat, 95-98% of the meat is grown traditionally with antibiotics fed to the animals along the way. And, you know, with this organic or grown without antibiotics, people say, well, you know, that's great, but that's elitist, not everybody can afford that. I've heard all those issues. NSA did a study back in 99, which is 10 years old now, but they show that the cost of meat, presuming that the cost to the farmers and the ranchers would be shifted to the consumer, which makes sense and would be fair, but that cost, if they looking at all the different studies, would be $4 to $10 per person per year. That's 25 cents a week increase in meat. I heard last night someone was saying that, you know, the cost of pork really hasn't gone up since the 60s. And, you know, if cheap meat is the only thing you're looking for, that's great. If safe and meat is what you're looking for, that may or may not make a difference. The other thing is commodities, asking about, you know, where is your school getting their meat? What is their source of meat? Chicago Public Schools have just started a pilot program where they're going to be serving chicken drumsticks, so they're not going to give the kids chicken, processed chicken patties, cutlets, whatever, but whole drumsticks and from chicken that are raised completely without antibiotics, and they're going to be giving that once a month as sort of a pilot project to see how that goes. So reducing, you know, the results of reducing animal use, will it make a difference in resistance, and resistance especially in humans? And that was the question that Dr. Wong raised. And she talked about the safety for resistance in the salmonella in the Salmonella Heidelberg in Quebec. And their data, to me, clearly indicates that we've got this temporal association and you have decreased levels of contamination. And as noted, the tetracyclines aren't used to treat salmonella, but looking at the safety for resistance. And the Canadians figured that their interpretation of the data, and after all, it is their data, so they think the reason that went down in some of the other provinces is that especially Quebec and Ontario share hatcheries, they share a lot of the same things. So there was a spillover. Potentially, they don't know. Nobody knows that for sure because they didn't ask. This was a study just done in Quebec. But the realities are there just haven't been a lot of studies done to look at whether it makes a difference in resistance. And it's a tough thing, you know, because it isn't this easy, simple, linear thing. It's sort of like, did this cigarette cause this cancer? And, you know, those are not easy studies to do, and they just, you know, they haven't been done. And it comes down to how much certainty do you need to regulate judiciously. And the ADMA has taken the stance that we need to have risk analysis on a drug by bug, by species, and we must demonstrate public harm before we can make any action. That's really a delaying tactic. That's really not public health. That's not getting to what we need to be getting to. If policy is made on the basis of a risk analysis, you could make the same argument that you should do a risk analysis to demonstrate that there's no harm or there's a lack of harm by giving antibiotics before you proceed with the known risk of antimicrobial resistance. That's not the way it's posed with ADMA at this point. Once resistance occurs, are we going to have this new normal? We already know that, you know, that we have antibiotic resistance, and what were things like back in the 40s and the 50s versus what we've got now as far as antibiotic resistance, and we don't have a lot of data on that. But whether or not you disallow non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in food animals, whether that's really going to solve the problem really isn't the question. The question is, will it help, and is it appropriate and is it a reasonable response? And I think that question's been answered. That question's yes. Because the use and the overuse of antibiotics anyway that can pose a health threat to animals or humans, it can pose a threat anywhere, and so the prudent use of antibiotics must happen in all cases, whether we're talking about people or food animals or pets or anybody. Basically, we all have to be good stewards of our antibiotics. So with that, I'll try to give a few minutes for questions. Oh, I guess you're supposed to do that.
Yes, questions, like, and I forgot, please repeat the question.
Yeah, I'll try to do that.
Go ahead.
So in your definition of non-therapeutic use of, or therapeutic use of antibiotics, you said do you include control or preventative uses of antibiotics? Because I think that's the biggest contention is the clarity of non-therapeutic use. If you make that blank statement, it looks like it regulates preventative usages and control usages of antibiotics. If that's not the case, then I'm more amenable, and I think a lot of other veterinarians are amenable to going for that legislation. But unless you clearly articulate that argument that therapeutic use includes control and well-recognized preventative measures, we can't have, nobody can endorse that.
Okay, and the question was, the statement was that we really need to, what is my definition of therapeutic versus non-therapeutic, or the Pew Commission or PAMT or whatever, but my definition, Pew definition of therapeutic versus non-therapeutic, and does the PAMT legislation define that so narrowly that only diagnosed sick animals could be treated? And I do look at, as I said, animals that have been exposed to a disease should certainly be allowed to be treated. That's not as clear in the PAMTA legislation. And they talk about routine use, but that doesn't mean, as a veterinarian, when I hear routine use, I think of, I use antibiotics routinely to treat animals. That's not what's meant by that legislation. That's not how FDA has interpreted it when they've looked at the legislation. The only one who's looked at it that way has been AVMA, from what I can tell. Who first? Back to Steve. Okay.
Okay. Well, this is so. Go back to your experience on Capitol Hill, and give me a sense of how likely it is that PAMTA might actually pass.
The question is, how likely do I think that PAMTA is going to pass? My experience on Capitol Hill in this session. PAMTA, and I think any legislation that has a chance of passing this session has to have bipartisan support. And right now, there's nothing that has bipartisan support on the Hill. but PAMTA has been introduced. This is not the first time. It was introduced in the last session of Congress and got some hearings but never went to committee. So it's like this whole long way that things become law. It was introduced actually first by Sherrod Brown out of Ohio when he was on the House side. So that's at least 6 years ago. So it's been introduced in at least three or four different Congresses. How likely it is, I don't know, but that's why at least the Pew Health and Industrial Farming is looking at what is FDA doing. We're encouraged that FDA has gotten some things on paper, but looking at the consumer use of and consumer change, looking at regulatory issues, and looking at potentially changing legislation, which is not an easy thing to do in these days. There's a question over here.
You mentioned the WHO, OIE, and FAO statement on just cost effectiveness and how it's not necessarily detrimental to stop using antibiotics. Did that look at it between small farms and large farms, or family farms versus industrial farms?
The question was, for the WHO, FAO, OIE report, did they look at the difference between family farms and so-called small farms or big farms? And I mean, in this country, they say 95% of the farms are family farms, and they are depending on what's your definition of family farm. They're contracted farmers. They looked at it overall. I don't know if it was looked at specifically of large farms versus small farms. But if you look in, you look at Denmark where they don't use antibiotics, that's a very small country, but they have very intensive farming. Most of those farms are not small farms of 10 or 15 pigs. They're large farms of several thousand pigs. And they, as Dr. Wong pointed out, they send out most of their grower finishers, mostly to Germany and Poland. Most of that has to do with the economics, that getting them processed and working them just because of their labor costs are just higher, way higher in Denmark than they are in Germany and Poland. So that's why they're exporting them.
This is probably a little bit more of a comment than a question, but I think that from the first two presentations we saw that there was some inconclusive evidence as to the scientific evidence for resistance, but it is, an issue that I think everyone's addressing. But just to comment on an industry perspective, I know you talked a little bit about some of the programs that are there, like PQA Plus and how they weren't regulatory, which is true, they're not regulatory at a federal level, but from the swine industry perspective, all major packers require that pigs are PQA Plus when they're bought through contracts or on the spot market. So there's a lot of oversight out there in the industry and a lot of attention through veterinarians, like Christine said, but also through producers on PQA Plus and judicious use of antibiotics, including the husbandry practices as part of PQA Plus, which is your comment, I think, and as part of that, making sure good production practices are in place so that antibiotics aren't necessarily needed unless they are needed. And I think from industry's perspective, that's something we really want to protect, is making sure we have these in place to protect animal health and human health.
And let me just put that in for the record as best I can. The comment was that in the swine industry, especially looking at the PQA Plus, which is for the swine industry, that it's not a regulation, but they hold their members accountable to follow PQA Plus. Yeah. Okay, is that succinct? Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to have two more questions for anyone in the panel.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And then that'll be the official end of it. But then, people can get up and leave or not leave at their discretion. So.
Well, the question that I had, yesterday, I'm a human clinician, veterinary clinician, and so I see a lot of MRSA, which is community acquired, and heard in lectures yesterday that there's a real link and obvious source of multi-resistant staph aureus in animal farming, and therefore is now translating to community sources. So that scares me a lot, since there are more people who die of MRSA in this country than HIV and TB. And I see it every day when people come in and are very worried about staph. That my concern is that why would you use antibiotics? I saw some of those graphs of the resistance to tetracycline and some of the other antibiotics. Why would you even use those antibiotics in animals when your resistance is already so incredibly high? And knowing the fact that we are creating these superbugs, the campylobacters that are multiple resistant, the E. coli that are multiple resistant to melanin, some people are resistant to your sickle. It's scary to me to see all these people who are incredibly ill and potentially dying, that we have a resistance that's already being developed in animals. We have a lot of resistance already in the organisms that are in the animals. You can show that. You showed a lot of data that showed that. Why would you keep persisting on the same area and in the same way and using antibiotics in the same way? Mm-hmm. And I'm asking this question about this.
Well, and Dr. Wong, you want to come up here? Because then it gets into the microphone. And
Thank you.
I've done your job a couple times, too. And the question, I'll let you repeat the question.
Yeah. Essentially, the question is, why would you keep using antibiotics in animals in a sub-therapeutic manner, right? Is that the question?
Because
of the resistance that is already there. Well, first of all, I guess the question is, what are you calling subtherapeutic? And I'm assuming that's, anything less than at a dosage for treatment. Well, in veterinary medicine, first of all, what we use at a treatment level is for clinically ill animals, what you see as, you know, clinical signs, an animal that is obviously sick. In production medicine with food animals, we have a lot of infectious diseases. It's common. You have a herd or a flock, you have a lot of animals, disease spreads very, very quickly. They are housed together. So we need the antibiotics to protect animal health as well as human health, actually, for food safety purposes. One of the examples I like to use is a disease called air sacculitis in chickens. And what happens with that particular disease is it's not something that you can see until you actually take that animal to slaughter. So what happens is if you do not treat that disease, and you can't see it, it's not something you see until you take that animal to slaughter, what happens is when you cut that animal open, the tissue is very, it's fragile, and you will have a harder time slaughtering that animal. The disease kind of causes a difficulty in slaughtering the animal, getting the carcass apart, and then you'll have a higher likelihood of fecal contamination of the meat, and therefore it's a food safety hazard. As you understand, you know, having fecal contamination of a poultry product would cause a food safety hazard. So in that sense, there's a reason to actually use antibiotics to control the animal disease for a food safety concern.
And as opposed to spreading out the animals in a way that they aren't all getting sick. In other words, what you're saying is the way the food, the animals are being produced today makes them sick.
No, I'm not saying that, actually, because I don't know for a fact that spreading out the animals however far, I mean, I don't know how far you would have to spread these animals for them not to get air sacculitis. I mean, it is an infectious disease. So, I mean, do you have to spread these animals out, you know, and give them a hug, you know, 10...
Yeah, my comment... Yeah, my comment is that you can raise animals without antibiotics and not have air sacculitis. It isn't a condition of being a bird.
Right.
I think what you're
right, and it is a balance. You know, there's actually a chart on the ABMA website where you can look at the differences in the different types of housing for poultry specifically, actually, and it'll show you the balances between the different types of housing and the and the different disease processes, as well as the animal welfare benefits and negative effects, and it's kind of color coded so that you can look and see. And unfortunately, with certain types of housing, it is better for certain behaviors on an animal welfare perspective. But at the same time, for biosecurity purposes, it may not be as good. So it is a balance. With certain types of housing components, it's better for the animal in terms of being able to control biosecurity and being able to control certain diseases, but then, you know, on the flip side, other diseases are not as easy to control. So it is a balance on both sides. You know, it may be better for certain animal welfare things, like, you know, certain, and again, this is not my area of expertise, animal welfare, but for certain behaviors like feather picking or whatever, it's better to be able to house them differently. But then, you know, for certain disease prevention efforts, it is better to house them in a different way. So it is always a balance between different things when it comes to animal production for food.
Last official question, then we're off the clock, but I don't think anybody will walk out. So.
My question is about using antibiotics for growth promotion.
Yes.
Is the evidence as to how significantly antibiotic use contributes to growth promotion convincing in your opinion? Because I think Dr. Hansen, you mentioned about $4 a year, which doesn't seem to a consumer a significant contribution. What's your opinion?
The ABMA's perspective on that is a little difficult because the evidence that we have on it is there are drugs that are available for growth promotion, and it's written like that on the label. It's for increased rate of gain or feed conversion and that type of thing. So oftentimes, because these drugs are available over the counter and that's what's written on the label, that's what they're approved for. We do know that that is the nature of the beast. It is for economic gain, and that's what some people use it for. At the same time, we also know that there's scientific evidence that shows that some of these doves do also prevent disease when used at that same level. For that particular dose, whether it's, you know, like 500 grams per ton or whatever it is. So it's something that goes on as a regular debate amongst our profession. You know, there's some people that sit there and say, well, you know, it is for economic gain, and that's inappropriate, and that's not our fight, because we are medical health professionals. So that's not a debate that we really need to get into. On the other hand, you know, we have professionals who say, well, you know, yeah, sure, that's what it says on the label. It says it's for growth promotion, but it's being used to prevent disease, and that is perfectly appropriate because we are medical health professionals, and we do need to prevent disease before it spreads throughout this entire herd or flock, and now we have 1,000 animals that are sick, and they are all sick, and it is incumbent upon us as medical health professionals to ensure that all of these animals are not sick and suffering.
Why
so it is difficult. There is scientific evidence, depending on the drug, and in some species, depending on the drug, and in certain species, that it does work as a preventative. So it does depend on the drug in certain species and what disease. So again, it is drug bug dependent.
I'm going to make one comment, and then I'll just throw it open because I see it. Some of this is touching on a topic that we want to discuss next year, and that is modern agricultural practices. So that will be, that's a topic we're going to work on next year. A similar forum, but some of this bleeds into that. So anyway, that's what we'll be working on next year.
Thank you.
I don't mind continuing if...
Please.
Yeah.
The speakers mentioned that the drugs that we've discussed primarily are not used in human use. And yet, I'm asking about more of a global consideration. That may be true in the United States, but what is our global responsibility to populations who may not have access to the generation drugs that we have? And those are the drugs that we have.
Well, and actually, most of the drugs that are used in animal production are the same drugs that are used in human medicine. They're not different drugs. They are the same drugs. And you're exactly right that they're, you know, how drugs are used in this country or used in Western Europe are different than how they may be used in the rest of the world, used in aquatic medicine, whatever.
Yeah.
And so we do have the issue, and WHO has looked at that issue of critically important drugs, and that we do really need to be looking at down the road. We need to be looking at, will we have these drugs for our animals to treat our animals when they're sick and to treat our humans when they're sick, as a global issue. And that's what WHO has looked at, and that was why they came up with their recommendations.
I'd like to address that as well. That's one of AVMA's significant concerns with PAMTA, is that all the drug classes that are listed there are the human drugs, the drugs that are important in human medicine. Unfortunately, there are no other drugs to use in veterinary medicine either. The same drugs that are important in human medicine are also important in veterinary medicine. It leaves us with essentially two classes of drugs to use in veterinary medicine, and unfortunately those drugs aren't exactly very effective as veterinary drugs. They are ionophores, and actually now there are no arsenicals available for veterinary medicine uses anymore, so it's actually one class because the other one was just voluntarily withdrawn recently. So and it's not a very effective drug class. So there isn't really no such thing as human drugs and veterinary antimicrobials. They're all in the same classes. There really just aren't that many antimicrobials available for use in general. I mean, everybody knows that there aren't that many drugs in the pipeline for either group, whether it's humans or animals. So, you know, the drugs that are available for human medicine, there's even less available for veterinary medicine. And so what we've got is what we've got. There really aren't any new drugs being developed for veterinary medicine. And so if this class that is, or this list of drugs that's named in PAMTA is withdrawn, there won't be anything left for us to treat the animals with. and then what? You know, we've got sick animals, and all of these drugs are withdrawn. What are we going to treat them with? We're going to be left with essentially what they do in Europe is cull. So we will cull all of these animals. Whether or not that's a significant welfare concern, I don't really know, but that's what's going to be done, is the animals will be culled.
And I think that's a little bit disingenuous, however, because PAMTA doesn't say that those antibiotics would not be available to veterinary use. In fact, it says it will be available for veterinary use to treat animals with disease, if you have a diagnosed disease, but it is not available to treat animals for growth promotion or when you don't have a disease in the animal.
It is very obvious that we are having a big challenge. I mean, we are in bad public health. The reality is that we need to do more study on this, because do we know whether the resistance that you're getting in humans is coming from the overuse of drugs in humans, or whether or not it's the contribution from animals? Very often it comes the way where we tend to focus on the veterinary aspect, but it can be also overuse of drugs, you know, among people themselves. That's one. The second thing we have to look at is that we, more and more, as you said, more and more farmers are getting involved in using drugs, and the veterinarians have very little control over that. So the issue is really much greater than just a veterinary issue and the use of using for infections or non-infections. And I think we have to look at this in a much broader sphere.
Agreed. I mean, and we very much, as a profession, the veterinary profession is really trying very hard right now to work with the FDA to ensure that there is that veterinary control and that veterinary oversight, so that we have an idea of how those drugs are being used, and have control over it. The question is just, how are we going to be able to do that? And it, like I said, it's not so simple as to say, okay, well, we'll just make everything prescription only, because it isn't the same way that it is in the human profession, where we could just make it prescription only because we have that feed route and we have the feed mill and we have to work through them, and then we also have, you know, the oral administration and the water and the intramammary and, you know, and the injectables and stuff that's sold at the smaller feed stores, and, you know, and there's still all of these logistics that we have to work through. And again, you know, we're trying very hard, and we are working with the FDA with that, and trying to figure out how exactly that is going to happen, but we are in agreement that that does need to happen. So that is one step that we are doing, and we are moving forward, so that is something that everybody is in agreement on, that we, you know, we do need to have this greater level of oversight of these drugs to ensure that they are being used properly.
And granted, you know, you're not going to be able to snap your fingers and have that happen. However, the European Union has figured out how to do this. They've had antibiotics are under veterinary prescription. Done. Wasn't done like that, obviously. And there was pushback. And there was pushback from the farmers. You talk to the Danes who did that back 20 years ago, and you ask the farmers, think that was a good idea? No, they hated it. They thought it was going to be the end of their business. And when they took fluoroquinolones out of poultry in this country, I remember the poultry producers saying, this will be the end of poultry as we know it. Our poultry industry will die and be gone. And, of course, that happened.